Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Ambassador Peter Galbraith, who served as the United States' first ambassador to Croatia. He is currently a senior diplomatic fellow at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation and a regular contributor to the New York Review of Books. His new book is The End of Iraq, How American Incompetence Created a War Without End. And Ambassador Galbraith has just left Iraq, and he's in Jordan. And we spoke to him a moment ago. He'll be joining us in a moment and giving us an update on the situation on the ground in Iraq. And we'll also speak with Dr. Chalmers Johnson, who's an author and professor emeritus at the University of California, San Diego. He has written numerous books, including Blowback, The Cost and Consequences of American Empire, and The Sorrow of Empire, Militarism, Secrecy, and the End of the Republic. And we'll be talking to him about the ascendance of the conservative Japanese politician and what was passed in the Senate this week, both in terms of the prisoner treatment, the bill, torture bill, if you will, and the record defense budget. Let's now go to Jordan to speak with Ambassador Peter Galbraith, who I spoke with just a little while ago. I'm speaking with Ambassador Peter Galbraith, the former United States Ambassador to Croatia, formerly a professor at the National War College, United Nations Special Representative in East Timor, and the author of The End of Iraq, How American Incompetence Created a War Without End. And Ambassador Galbraith, as I'm sure you know, as we get closer to the midterm elections, the Iraq war, in effect, might well determine whether the Democrats will take the House and perhaps the Senate. So as long as the focus is on Iraq, it looks as if the Democrats may take the House. But if the focus is shifted to the war on terror, then perhaps the president and the Republicans will hold on. You've just left Iraq. Give us your sense of what the state of Iraq is now.
Every time I go, the situation is worse. But this time, there's the real stench of defeat in the air. It really becomes time for the United States to start to think about what defeat will look like. I was in Kurdistan, which is safe and secure, but it's a great window on Iraq. Universally, the Kurdish leaders with whom I spoke are deeply pessimistic. They're quite certain the country will split up into three parts. And they also describe the Americans as no longer being proactive, leaving the embassy, but really focused on protecting themselves and playing less and less of a role in Iraq. It is a situation that has become chaotic. And it's very hard to see any resolution to the chaos.
Well, of course, the scandal du jour, if you will, is the new book by Bob Woodward titled State of Denial. And it makes the argument that one of the reasons we're in this mess is that the president hasn't been dealing with reality and that the reality has been getting increasingly worse. That seems to be what you've just told me.
It's a very striking. The president seems totally disconnected in his public statements from the reality in Iraq, and indeed, by all accounts from his aides and from what I've read of the new book. But frankly, just before coming to Iraq, I spent 4 days in Washington, D.C., and I was amazed at the disconnect between the policy community in Washington, D.C., both inside the government and outside, and the very stark reality on the ground in Iraq. People in Washington, including critics of the war, talk about the most implausible kinds of solutions. For example, restructuring Iraq's oil industry so every Iraqi would be a shareholder like Alaska. It's even more absurd than rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic.
So in other words, what you're saying is that even the opposition, the Democrats, are essentially dealing with unreality because they're suggesting that there are some options. And what you're saying is that there are no options?
Well, in this case, it wasn't Democrats so much as Middle East experts in Washington. But the Democrats have adopted a strategy that they're not going to offer much specific on the way of Iraq because the Republicans are doing such a great job of damaging themselves politically. And I suspect that will be a good political tactic. And I think there's an excellent chance as the country looks at this, what has happened in Iraq, by far the most incompetent foreign policy venture in my lifetime, that they will punish the Republicans. But in terms of what's good for America, I disagree with the Democrats who don't offer an alternative. We are really in desperate situation. We are at the point where we have to think about what defeat will look like, what it's going to mean for Iraq, for the United States. The Democrats ought to be offering more than letting the Republicans hang themselves.
But curiously, though, President Bush's blunder has become the Democrats' problem. And if he says that all they offer is cut and run, isn't it up to the president to admit defeat, not the Democrats?
Well, the president describing that opposition as cut and run is totally pathetic. He's the one who failed to plan for the post-war, sent American troops who were terrific professionals into Baghdad with not any thought about how they might secure the city, prevent the looting. He changed his strategy more times than some people change their socks in terms of, yes, we're going to have an Iraqi interim government, no, we're not. They sent out incompetent politicals instead of professionals to run the occupation in Iraq, too few troops. It is a total denial, a state of denial about the realities on the ground. So the president is responsible for the disaster in Iraq, and nobody should take seriously his effort to shift the blame. That said, again, I think the Democrats ought to be coming up and offering alternatives. The one person who has offered some alternative is Senator Joe Biden, who basically says the country is broken up and we need a loose federal system. That's, in fact, what's happened. I don't think it will solve the problem, but at least it's facing up to reality.
And that sort of echoes your recent op-ed piece, Ambassador Peter Galbraith, in the New York Times, Our Corner of Iraq. If the situation devolves and you do have a breakup, the relatively stable part in the north, the Kurdish north, might well be the only place that the United States can retreat into. After all, the route that they came in from Kuwait is essentially Indian territory. If the other shoe drops and the Shia start attacking as much as the Sunni do, and I understand. Basically, the reason we don't have a full-scale civil war is that the Shia are keeping their powder dry because the United States is essentially beating up on their enemy, the Sunni.
Well, first, the United States has enough force that it can withdraw from Iraq by whatever route it chooses to withdraw, so that's not the issue. What I argue is that we should withdraw from the parts of Iraq where we're accomplishing nothing. And the best case of that is the southern half of the country. Under George Bush's watch, that has already been turned over to pro-Iranian political parties and clerics who run it as an Iranian-type theocracy, except generally much stricter than what exists in Iran. And that type of rule is enforced by Shiite militias that number tens of thousands that grew up under the American occupation. Now, we have absolutely no intention of disarming those militias. We have no intention of promoting democracy in the southern half of the country. We have no intention of getting the Iranians out. In those circumstances, there's no purpose served by our presence there, and I argue that we should withdraw from the south. If we were to try to do any of those things, we'd need three or four times as many troops because we would be making the Shiites as our enemy, and they would have a powerful ally right next door in Iran. I also argue that we're basically doing nothing to stop the civil war in the mixed Sunni-Shiite areas, particularly in Baghdad. And if we're not going to stop the civil war, just this week we had 200 bodies turn up in a single day. If we're not going to stop the civil war, what purpose is served by us being in Baghdad and the other mixed areas? And the final point I make is that yes, we do have one overriding interest in Iraq that's at least achievable, and that's preventing al-Qaeda from having a base there. Now, al-Qaeda has certainly gotten a lot of support in Iraq thanks to the invasion and the incompetent occupation, but that doesn't mean we can just walk away. But the current strategy that we're using to fight al-Qaeda is also clearly not working, and the reason it's not working is that we seem to be, at least the administration and the president, clueless that this country's devolved into civil war. Our strategy involves using what we call as the Iraqi security forces, Iraqi troops, Iraqi police, as if there was such a thing. In fact, those troops and those police are mostly Shiite, and they are partisans in the civil war. So when they're used against the Sunnis, insurgents, of course, they're not seen as fellow citizens. They're seen as the enemy, and it only breeds more support for the insurgency. I think that we have to try a different approach, which is to make the Sunnis responsible for their security in their own state or province, and then get out of there as well. But my thought about going to Kurdistan is twofold. First, that we owe a moral debt to the Kurds who fought on our side in the war and who have created the kind of relatively democratic pro-Western place that we wanted for all of Iraq. But more importantly, that we ought to be there because it's an insurance policy in case we need to move into other parts of Iraq.
And Ambassador Galbraith, I mean, I guess the larger point, the point I was trying to make was that it seems that we have effectively been doing the dirty work for the Shias to the extent that we've been fighting in a largely Sunni insurgency, and the Marine Corps just came up with an intelligence report that was leaked suggesting that we, for all intents and purposes, have lost Al-Anbar province. And Al-Anbar province is, in effect, the redoubt for the Sunnis because the Shia are conducting ethnic cleansing, as far as one can see, even in Baghdad itself. So my question is when does the other shoe drop? In other words, we did have a brief period where we fought the Muqtada al-Sadr's militia, but so far, it's been us versus the Sunni with the Shia death squads running amok. And my sense is that perhaps since the Shia are Iranian surrogates largely, perhaps they're holding their reins, they're reining them in for some other possibility. And could that possibility be an insurance policy against our government and our administration doing something against Iran?
Well, there are a lot of
questions in that. I'm sorry.
Yeah, of course. The first point I would make is that, in fairness to the Shiites, they exercised a lot of restraint, and it's the Sunnis who started the civil war, or at least the Sunni insurgents, by attacking and killing thousands of Shiite civilians with car bombs and suicide bombs, people at religious shrines, pilgrims, and just ordinary people at bus stations and things like that. So. And the Shiites didn't respond for a long time. The death squads are a response to the Sunni attacks. But it has now happened. The United States, to some extent we have been in an uneasy alliance with the Shiites, largely because they are the majority and they're the people who dominate the government. But the other shoe definitely could drop. Our relations with different Shiite parties are increasingly tense. Al-Sadr, the most radical of the Shiite clerics, has only gotten stronger since we moved into Iraq, and thanks again to the incompetent occupation. And he is poised to strike at the United States. The final point you make is an extremely important one. The Iranians have openly said that if the United States strikes at Iran, they can and will retaliate against the United States in Iraq, and the way they will do it is through the Shiite militias and that we've allowed to grow up. And where are those Shiite militias? In the south and in Baghdad. And that's why, frankly, I argue we have no business being in those places, that we basically are only hostages. And again, what your listeners have to bear in mind is that we are not now doing anything to counter Shiite power in the south, and George Bush has no intention of doing that.
And of course, Ambassador Garbeth, in the piece in the August issue of the New York Review of Books, Mindless in Iraq, you make the point, ironically, that there was a certain ironic symmetry here, that there was nobody inside the Pentagon who had the courage to tell Rumsfeld that he was wrong and we needed many, many more troops. And conversely, on the Iraqi side, there was nobody to tell Saddam that he was delusional as well, because he quite rightly understood that strategically it would be a massive blunder for the United States to invade Iraq, because it would then empower Iran. And he didn't think we were that stupid, apparently.
Well, that's exactly right. I reviewed several books, including Cobra 2 by Michael Gordon and Bernard Traynor, about the war. And one of the things that they learned in that book from debriefing the Iraqi generals is that Saddam was absolutely convinced that the Americans would not go to Baghdad, that yes, they might attack, they might move a little bit into the south, but they would never go to Baghdad because that would benefit Iran. It would bring the Shiites to power. And, of course, that would be such an illogical and unstrategic thing for the Americans to do. So he assumed that we would be thinking strategically. The Pentagon and the president, of course, the core of the problem is that they haven't thought strategically. In setting up and in deciding to invade Iraq, they didn't think strategically, in the sense that they focused on a country that clearly did not have nuclear weapons, so did not pose a nuclear threat prior to our decision to go to war. You can't hide nuclear facilities when you have inspectors in the country, but at the same time, by devoting all our attention to Iraq, we basically allowed the Iranians a free pass. They resumed enrichment of uranium, and not only that, we brought to power the people that they had been supporting for years. They have gotten a freebie out of this one. They fought an 8-year war with Iraq. Took a million lives, most of them Iranian. They were victims of poison gas attacks, and they couldn't get rid of Saddam, and they couldn't bring the Shiites to power, and the Americans did it all for them without a single Iranian getting killed and without a single dollar being spent by the Iranians.
And further to that, we got rid of their problem on the other side, the Taliban, who they almost went to war with. So I guess
precisely right.
Every day the mullahs wake up and say, "Thank you, great Satan."
Well, they may. I suspect they think that God works in mysterious ways, but they certainly think he's working on their side.
Well, let me ask you about your new book, Ambassador Peter Garbeth, The End of Iraq, How American Incompetence Created a War Without End. You went in with the invasion. You were there in a few days after the April 10th so-called victory, on April the 14th, and you were with ABC News, and with Brian Ross and with CIA officer Bob Baer, and you just were talking about this extraordinary treasure trove of intelligence that was being exposed, with the names and the dresses of all the bad guys who became the nucleus of the insurgency later, and you tried to get this information to the Pentagon, and it fell on deaf ears.
Yeah, at that time I was a consultant to ABC News, but I was still actually an employee of the Department of Defense, because I was professor at the National War College. I took some holiday to go do this job with ABC. And I had, you know, decent relations with Paul Wolfowitz. So we'd gone to Uday Hussein's house and found in the basement — Bob Baer had done this — the files of the Saddam Fedayeen. Now, that was the one guerrilla organization that had been fighting the Americans as they drove to Baghdad. It went on to become the nucleus of the resistance. It was headed by Saddam's sadistic and alcoholic elder son, Uday. So we gathered up these files, did the story on them, ABC Scoop with Brian Ross, and then, you know, what to do with them. Well, I felt that they would be valuable to the U.S. authorities. So I called Wolfowitz's office to try to arrange a pickup. And that we were in the Sheraton Hotel, surrounded by the U.S. military. I had to do it a bit discreetly because my journalistic colleagues were not so comfortable about this kind of thing. any event, the Pentagon couldn't arrange a pickup in a hotel surrounded by American troops. It was really staggering. And so these files, I think, basically disappeared.
And that was the very beginning. That was even before mission accomplished.
It was before mission accomplished. And this was, incidentally, not an isolated case. Hmm. We found right across from the Firdaus Square, where the statue had fallen, the wiretap center that the Iraqis had used, and it was full of transcripts of wiretaps. Again, I tried to get the Pentagon to secure it because the people, the squatters who had moved in, said the Iraqis were coming in telling them to burn the files. Nothing happened. I went through the foreign ministry 2 weeks after Baghdad fell. Nobody stopped me. There were safes. They were full of all sorts of documents. And the foreign ministry, this would be the place if Iraq was acquiring WMD from abroad, you might find purchase orders. If they had connections to al-Qaeda, as Cheney claimed, you might find some evidence there. It would have been through embassies abroad. Nobody had secured this. Nobody had made any effort to protect the files from looters or from Iraqis, former regime types who might want to destroy them.
Well, it's possible that foreign intelligence services were more on the ball than we were.
Well, I think that's actually likely in some of the cases. One of the other things that we saw was that Iraq didn't have weapons of mass destruction, as we now know, but it did have so-called dual-use activities, which were perfectly legal, but they were monitored by the United Nations because explosives, for example, that could be used for construction might be used for triggering a nuclear weapon. Or medical research could be used for biological weapons. Well, I watched as a facility that had been used for medical research that Colin Powell had warned as being so dangerous with live viruses. He'd warned this at the United Nations, the Baghdad Central Public Health Laboratory. That was looted while American troops were next door because the Pentagon planners never told them the facility was important. They just watched. And in another case, Iraqis looted 400 tons of high explosives, which were usable for and acquired for the purpose of causing the uranium to implode.
That's the most sophisticated plastic explosive there is.
Exactly right, and this wasn't looted in this was, it would have taken 40 10-ton trucks to take the supplies. This took place over months. And while some things may have just been, you know, ordinary poor people breaking in and taking stuff, that might have been the case at the Central Public Health Laboratory. In the case of these sophisticated explosives, the circumstances to me suggest that Iranian agents may have taken it, and the Iranians would have loved to get hold of these supplies because, of course, it would help their nuclear program. Mm-hmm. Or the other alternative is it was a Sunni insurgents for whom these weapons are terrific tools. Incidentally, I said 400 tons were taken, less than 1 pound brought down Pan Am 103 in 1989.
And of course, this cache of sophisticated plastic explosive was identified by the UN for the very purpose that it was a part of a nuclear capable mix. So
the UN not only identified it before the war, they inspected it before the war, and on the 10th of April, they went at the International Atomic Energy Agency specifically told the United States, secure this place, and we didn't.
And just in closing, Ambassador Peter Galbraith, since you've just left Baghdad, where there's a curfew, and there was also rumors of a coup attempt on the part of the army against al-Maliki, whose government, even the Baker Commission, that is not due to issue its report until after the elections, they went public recently saying that al-Maliki had 3 months to pull it together. It certainly doesn't appear to be the case. Just going back to your the scenario that you offered in the New York Times op-ed about our corner of Iraq, the idea that we should retreat in effect to the Kurdish redoubt and then have the ability to intervene if necessary, but that would, of course, would require our political authorities to admit the extent to which the whole thing has failed. How viable, though, is any kind of Kurdish area, given that it's landlocked and surrounded by hostile neighbors, in particular the Turks?
Well, first, there are many landlocked countries in the world, and Uzbekistan is actually double landlocked, so it's not without precedent. And other countries will need what Kurdistan has, which is a fair amount of oil. But not all the neighbors are so hostile. First, there's the possibility of a velvet divorce with the rest of Iraq, some of whom are getting very tired of the Kurds because they don't want to be part of the country. But more importantly, the relations between the Kurds and Turkey have, I wouldn't say that they're entirely smooth, but Turkey has had a very pragmatic approach. It's been supportive of the Iraqi Kurdish leadership. The largest investors in northern Iraq and Kurdistan are Turkish companies. They're helping the Kurds develop their own oil industry on contracts that are not approved by Baghdad. And there are many people in Turkey, including some in the military and the government. It may not be a majority view, but it's a sizable minority who say, basically, an independent Kurdistan is inevitable, and it may not be such a bad thing for us. After all, who are the Kurds? They are Western-oriented, they're secular, they aspire to be democratic, and they're not Arabs. In short, they're rather like us.
And, of course, what would make them viable would be the oil in Mosul and Kirkuk, all of which is pumped through Turkey. But there's some problems with the fact that Saddam introduced Sunni squatters, if you will, and there's been friction between the squatters and the Kurds who want to take back their property.
Well, this is particularly true in Kirkuk, where Saddam, actually he brought Shiite settlers from the south, but they were Arabs. But many of these people now want to return home, and there's an agreement in the Iraqi constitution that they should be given money to return home, and that the Kurds who were ethnically cleansed ought to be able to come back and recover their property. And indeed, Kurds have been coming back. It's a very tense city, but before the war, I think many people thought it would be the most volatile place in Iraq. It could blow up, but so far, compared to the rest of the country, it's not that bad. Incidentally, I don't think you'll see a Kurdistan declaring its independence anytime soon. I think it's likely in the next 10 years, but not in the next 2 years. But something like a coup in Baghdad, if that happened, yes, that could trigger a declaration of independence.
Well, just in closing, what will it take for the president to face reality, and particularly the vice president, who seems to have an inordinate role in all of this, because according to Woodward, both Laura Bush and his chief of staff, Andy Card, tried to have Rumsfeld fired, and apparently Cheney stopped that. So, and then, of course, we know that Cheney and Rumsfeld are joined at the hip. They have a long history together. What will it take for the president to face up to the reality of what really is happening in Iraq, and by extension, the president's constituency? Because let's face it, I don't believe the press in this country has done a great job in portraying the real face of the failure there. Many times the administration complains that we're not getting the good news in Iraq. You could argue that we're not really getting the bad news.
Well, I think that's right. I think Americans have no idea as to just how grim the situation is. And the reason we're not getting the good news is that there is no good news coming out of Iraq. One of the things that was going on when I was in Kurdistan is the Americans were talking to the Kurds about having a transfer of security from the coalition to the Kurds. Well, everybody thought it was a big joke because the coalition is providing no security in Kurdistan. It's by the local Kurdistan army. But the Americans wanted to do it. As the American generals freely admitted, they said they wanted to have a propaganda ploy for the president before the elections. It's this kind of escape from reality and frankly, some cases, just political calculation that really is part of what makes the situation depressing. As to what's going to change Bush's mind, well, I think I'm not a psychiatrist. I can't say, because the facts are so obvious. But if he doesn't change his mind, it is a truly depressing prospect that we are going to have U.S. troops committed to a mission that we are not going to prevail in. We're not going to build a unified and democratic Iraq, which is the mission that the president proclaims. The situation is simply going to be worse. And without having accomplished anything, the next president will withdraw, whether it's a Democrat or a Republican. The problem the president has is that this is the only thing his administration has done. And, of course, if this is a failure, and it is, it's basically saying that his entire administration's been a failure.
Well, apparently, according to Woodward, his father, President Bush, 41, has sleepless nights worrying about Iraq. So, at least somebody in the family gets it.
well. Frankly, we all ought to be having sleepless nights worrying about Iraq. I do. It is something that has so weakened the United States. Our standing in the world couldn't be lower. The Iranians are laughing all the way to the bank. We all ought to be having sleepless nights.
I thank you so much for joining us from Amman, Jordan, Ambassador Peter Galbraith.
And very good talking to you.
Bye-bye.
And hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I was just speaking then with Ambassador Peter Galbraith, who serves as the first United States ambassador to Croatia. He's currently a senior diplomatic fellow at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation, a regular contributor to the New York Review of Books, and his new book is The End of Iraq, How American Incompetence Created a War Without End. And he just returned from Iraq, where he spent a considerable amount of time, particularly with the Kurds in the north. I'm now speaking with Dr. Chalmers Johnson, who's an author and professor emeritus at the University of California, San Diego. He's also president and co-founder of the Japan Policy Research Institute, an organization promoting public education about Japan and Asia. He's written numerous books, including most recently two essential examinations of the consequences of American Empire blowback, The Cost and Consequences of American Empire, and The Sorrows of Empire, subtitled Militarism, Secrecy, and the End of the Republic. And Dr. Johnson was centrally featured in the Eugene Jarecki-directed film Why We Fight, which won the 2005 Cannes Jury Prize at the Sundance Film Festival. And I thank you for joining us, Dr. Johnson. And let me begin. I'd like to talk to you about what was went through the Senate this week, extraordinary and egregious defense bill and the so-called torture bill. But let's touch on Japan, the extent to which the new Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe is apparently vowing to rewrite the Japan's post-war, anti-war constitution. Is he, as I suspect, something of a darling of our neoconservatives, given that if Japan starts to rearm, of course, that will cause China to do the same thing, and the neocons clearly want to gin up an arms race with China?
Ian, I think rather than a darling of the neocons, we have to say he may be a Frankenstein. They've been pushing for some time to cause Japan to rearm it is quite rearmed, it is right now, but to rearm with offensive weapons. They have in mind that Japan, they often use the phrase, could become an East Asian Britain, meaning our most loyal and satellite, and they could use it both to counterbalance North Korea and perhaps, it seems absurd, but that perhaps also China. The result has been, that is to say, we've had Colin Powell said in Tokyo once that Japan cannot ever think of joining the UN Security Council unless it changes its American-written pacifist constitution. People like Richard Armitage, who have more influence in Tokyo than they should, are nonetheless forever interfering in Japanese politics, claiming that the pacifist constitution is outmoded. The result is that Shinzo Abe, the grandson of Kishi Nobusuke, former prime minister in the Eisenhower administration, former Minister of Munitions during World War II, former unindicted war criminal, has now become Prime Minister on a wave of nationalism, of antagonism with China and with South Korea. The leaders of China and of our alliance ally, South Korea, refused to meet with Prime Minister Koizumi, who just left office this past week. It's very hard to see how anything good can come of this. Let me just make one point I think that's critically important. It's commonly argued in the press and by people who don't know much about these things that Japan never apologized for World War II. That's been hammered home for years. The truth of the matter is there was an apology, and a very important one, and it's Article 9 of the Constitution, namely the anti-war clause, the clause that says Japan will not resort to war in international relations. When I first came to Japan in 1953, I can recall that even though this was written by General MacArthur and his staff, it had become nationalized in Japan. It created a great deal of idealism in the country. And it was the apology different from the German apology to the countries it had victimized. It says, since Japan is an island and not directly contiguous in the countries that it had invaded and ravished in many cases, that Japan, through Article 9, says, believe us, never again. We're not going to maintain the armed forces that would be required in order to ever think of doing anything again, such as we did during World War II, with consequences to the Chinese that were as serious as the consequences to Russia of the Nazi invasion in terms of killed civilian casualties. And there was a great deal of idealism surrounding it, both in East Asia and among the Japanese population. To have the Americans now being the leaders for getting rid of this idealistic doctrine, I recall when I was a graduate student, seemingly back in the Cenozoic, but our former ambassador, born and raised in Japan, Edwin Reischauer, once in an argument with him, I remember him saying, the payoff of World War II was a disarmed Japan. We should never do anything to threaten that. Well, these short-sighted people are threatening it, and it may very easily get out of control, and because Japan today can't balance China, it has to adjust to it. Japan's population is actually absolutely starting to decline now. It couldn't field a serious military force against anybody. It can certainly provide for its own defense. It could. It already is doing that very effectively. But its chief role in the world politics these days is to provide 91 military bases in its home islands and Okinawa for the American Empire. I think there are Americans who understand this has gone too far, that you're beginning to unleash forces in Japan that you won't be able to bottle up again, and that were never fully eliminated as a result of the victory of 1945. But Abe is the first example of that. His his positions are extremely belligerent.
And Thomas Johnson, surely if North Korea tests a nuclear weapon, then in many ways that anachronistic regime's only card to play is to sort of to be almost an international delinquent. Wouldn't that therefore give Abe the excuse for the Japanese to go nuclear? Because we know that they've got an enormous amount of plutonium, and they've probably some intelligence reports that indicate that they've prefabricated nuclear weapons and are ready to go nuclear.
Oh, this is proliferation without testing. I mean, Japan is as fully a nuclear power as any other. It gets a huge percentage, I can't remember the exact amount, of its electricity from nuclear power generation. It is easily the most advanced industrial country on Earth today. It is two Germanies in Northeast Asia. It is not a small country. It is the world's second most productive country. It is not a good idea to have it moving off into the direction of nuclear weapons, which will not defend it in any way. You're not going to convince China that that Japan is to be taken seriously as a counterfoil. At the same time, China is moving in a direction that all of us welcome. It is becoming the most capitalist of countries. It is in its fully materialist phase these days. And that the Japanese economy is today increasingly dependent on very profitable trade and manufacturing with China. It's what we need in Tokyo are some sensible, mature, intelligent leaders who know how to manipulate and work with the major transitions that are occurring in the world. I think an example of this is precisely South Korea, which is today, their leading trading partner is also China. They have very friendly relations with China. They work with China to try and defuse the threat from the North. That's what Japan ought to be doing instead of essentially trying to rewrite history and claim that they were justified in World War II, that World War II in East Asia was a war led by Japan to end imperialism, meaning Western imperialism in East Asia. They never would mention their own imperialism in Korea. And things of this are rewriting school textbooks, as well as the whole scandal over the Prime Minister's visits to Yasukuni Shrine, which is not a war memorial, but a monument to Japanese imperialism in downtown Tokyo, which he's done on numerous occasions this past year on the last day of the war, the anniversary on August 15th. This is just directly and openly insulting to the Chinese, who lost over 20 million people during World War II, or to the South Koreans, but not just to those two. It extends to Australia, to Singapore, to the Philippines, none of which have forgotten about what happened during World War II. They would like to live comfortably and in friendly relations with Japan. Japan has now decided to not make that possible.
Well, obviously, Thomas Johnson, what could be the counterweight would be the Japanese industrialists, who are much more pragmatic and understand China as their market. Maybe they can overcome the encouragement from our neoconservatives, who I've always argued actually are really shills and whores and flacks for the military-industrial complex. I think we give them far too much credit as strategic in terms of this, what would pass for any kind of strategic thinking.
I agree with you, but at the same time, I'd also point out that the Republican Party is itself hopelessly split between the neocon military-industrial complex, Pentagon mines on the one hand, and the Fortune 500 companies on the other, that are very, very heavily invested in China, that I guarantee you that the underwear we're all sitting in was manufactured in China. We are increasingly dependent upon imports from China. The largest single trade deficit we've ever had with any single country was last year with China. And that one would hope that these people would exert their influence. We see it in the new Secretary of the Treasury, Mr. Paulson, former chairman of the board of Goldman Sachs, who has extremely friendly relations in China and is apparently being given a pass by the Democrats because they trust him in the way they do not the militarists around the president. But yes, I agree with you. We would expect much greater influence from the Japanese manufacturing community. As it turns out, the real failure in all of this is the United States. One wishes to ask the U.S. ambassador, Mr. Schieffer, what does he think when he goes to Yasukuni Shrine, goes to that museum, and essentially looks at these one display after another that says that Pearl Harbor was induced by Franklin Roosevelt on the poor, innocent Japanese, that the rape of Nanking was just a small incident of no great importance, and one thing after another. The absurdity is it is not China or South Korea alone who should be protesting a rewriting of the history of World War II. It is the United States itself.
Let's move, if we can, Dr. Thomas Johnson, to what happened this week in the United States Senate. On Thursday, the Senate voted to eliminate habeas corpus, which is an essential element of the American legal process. It brings to mind the quote that you have in The Sorrows of Empire from Hannah Arendt, The Origins of Totalitarianism, quoting, "Although tyranny, because it needs no consent, may successfully rule over foreign peoples, it can stay in power only if it destroys first all the national institutions of its own people." And the New York Times, in an unusually impassioned editorial this week, called upon the Democrats to filibuster this bill, which, of course, they didn't do.
Yes.
This may well go down in history as one of our most shameful moments.
Not just shameful. It is also turning out to be a really very serious crisis. The new book of mine, the third in my trilogy that will be out early next year, is called Nemesis, The Last Days of the American Republic, which is concerned above all with a serious problem, namely the hopeless contradiction between a nation that is a domestic democracy and a foreign tyrant, that is, a foreign imperialist that, as Arendt says, rules because it does not need or require consent. It rules through force. History offers to us the greatest most empires have been both domestic tyrannies and foreign tyrannies, as in the case of Nazi Germany or Imperial Japan or the Soviet Union. The few rare examples of domestic democracies and foreign imperialists were the Roman Republic, after which the United States was largely modeled in the form of its separation of powers, and Great Britain. They offer two great and fundamental examples that the United States is getting caught up in today. The Roman Republic decided to hang on to its empire and in the process lost its domestic democracy, becoming a military dictatorship under Augustus Caesar. It's the first great example of democracy in force as a functioning form of government disappeared for well over 1,000 years anywhere. The British, by contrast, the example is not perfect, but it's pretty close to it. The British, after World War II, decided to let go their empire and get rid of most of their military apparatus in order to remain a domestic democracy. It is one of the most admirable things the British ever did. Now, granted, it was not without backtracking. There was Suez. There certainly was the atrocities committed in Kenya in 1950. The giving up of India was anything but a beautiful example of relinquishing power. But nonetheless, it seems to me that what this recent case, I don't mean to overstate it, but I believe this recent case does begin to point up to the assumption of tyrannical powers by the presidency in the name of maintenance of the empire, that is, preventive war, the disaster, the debacle that you've just been talking about with Ambassador Galbraith in Iraq, the lunatic overexpenditures that we're in today, where we can't even outfit our army in Iraq properly or send enough troops. At the same time, the Congress just this past week buys several dozen more F-22 Raptors that conceivably might have been useful in a war with the Soviet Union. That wasn't going to occur, and the Soviet Union disappeared 15 years ago anyway. There are now so many things piling up. The unbelievable amounts of money spent on anti-missile defense, most of which is simply scarecrow. It doesn't work. We know it doesn't work. The best scientific minds in the country have explained that it's science, not lack of money, that stands in the way of making this thing work. And the threat isn't realistic in any case, given there's no real threat assessment for the security of the United States today that is even slightly realistic. We're beginning to realize that the American economy increasingly depends upon arms manufacturing. That is a form of what technically is called military Keynesianism, the use of the military budget as a jobs program, as a way of maintaining reasonably high levels of employment.
But all of these things, I just
make the point, add up to say, what happened in pulling back habeas corpus, in giving the president the right to decide what techniques of interrogation amount to torture,
And who should be who on his say alone could be disappeared indefinitely?
Exactly. I mean, this is so catastrophic that to actually that it does begin strongly to suggest that George Bush is posing for the American democracy the same kind of problem that Julius Caesar posed for the Roman Republic in the Ides of March 44 B.C.
And, of course, this extra $70 billion for Iraq, along with keeping these worthless programs, as you mentioned, the F-22, the submarines, the ships, et cetera. And none of this has to do – these are all Cold War weapon systems, including Star Wars, of course.
They're basically military-industrial complex.
But that kind of right-wing welfare is coming at the expense of our ability to fight subnational and transnational threats, which are what the new threat profile is.
No question about it. That is the – the security of the United States is at risk daily, given the kind of the world we live in today. Afghanistan, they keep talking about, was a victory. Obviously, the Taliban was never defeated and never quit. And they have reformed themselves, and it seems anybody with a slight knowledge of history of South Asia must reflect on the enormous irony of a British army again finding themselves in southern Pashtun Afghanistan, around Kandahar, being decimated by these extremely brave fighters who did this back in the late 19th century to a British army in Afghanistan in which they allowed one to live. He was to go back over the Khyber Pass and tell the English what had happened to him. How, you have to say that just as speaking of the British record in giving up empire for the sake of democracy, Tony Blair comes out as an atavism, as a throwback to, the world of Lord Cromer and the British imperialists of the late 19th century.
The charge of the Light Brigade buffoon. Let me ask you then, I recently spoke with Ambassador Chas Freeman, and he described the Bush foreign policy as faith-based foreign policy, diplomacy-free foreign policy, hit-and-run democracy. And he's obviously something of the dean of our foreign service, and he's absolutely in a state of melancholia, you might say, because he's so appalled at what's happened to the United States' position in the world because of the wars that this president has taken us into, which he has never explained to the country, which is extraordinary. And he still, apparently, according to the new Woodward book, is in a state of denial. And so it leads you to really ask a similar question I asked Ambassador Galbraith earlier. What will it take, do you think, to wake up the American people? Because I have little to no faith in the American left, and particularly the progressives.
Yes.
They're wasting all their effort posturing about impeachment, which is a non-starter until you win the House, at any rate.
And it wouldn't make any difference.
But they've got to win the House, and by being so self-righteous, they're likely to offend any centrist voter who might consider voting Democrat in order for them to get the House in the first place when they can get subpoena power. So it's just a total no-brainer.
My answer to your question is that the thing that will, the chief obstacle in the continuation of this massive and out of control military industrial machine will be bankruptcy. That's not the end of the United States. Germany went bankrupt in 1923, China in 1948, Argentina in 2001, 2002. But it will mean a drastic lowering of our level of living, a loss of influence in international affairs. A need, if we're going to continue to live successfully in this world, to learn the manners and attitudes of poor people, but that we are now so overextended that all of the numbers we get in our various deficits turn out to be unprecedented in modern economic history. That trade deficits, current account deficits, fiscal deficits, household deficits, they're just one after another. And we're warned about it all the time. At the same time, we know why they haven't brought down the country yet. Both the Chinese and the Japanese, who are our main financiers and creditors, have decided that they're more interested in full employment domestically. Therefore, they want to continue to have access to the prolific, over-consuming American market. Therefore, they lend us unimaginable amounts of money. to continue to live on the tab.
Live above our means.
But rather famous rule by Herb Stein, who used to be the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers under Nixon, in which he was called Stein's Law. Now, things that can't go on forever don't.
Well, let me know quickly as we wrap up here, though. My feeling of what happened this week, though, Chalmers Johnson, was, again, a failure of American democracy. If you go back to the last midterm elections where the Karl Rove in the White House set up the Democrats before the elections with a phony vote, in that case, it was the war resolution vote that has since haunted Hillary Clinton, John Kerry, and John Edwards and others. The only guy that had any cojones was the chair of the Senate Select Intelligence Committee, Bob Graham, who knew the NIE was – he, in fact, commissioned the NIE. He knew that they were lying about the intelligence and the threat from Iraq. And lo and behold, the Democrats, they voted to essentially empower Bush to go to war and become a wartime president. They handed him a victory. Now, so Senator Daschle tried to renegotiate the schedule and said, let's postpone this vote until after the election. Let's make it truly bipartisan. Of course, Rove and Bush snickered all the way to the bank. So the same thing is just happening now. Again, our opposition is essentially playing by Karl Rove's playbook.
But I'm not sure it's a failure of democracy as much as it is a failure of the political system. It's not going to save us. We know that. Rove has proven himself how to manipulate the system. Moreover, we still just have a mystery why the citizen role has become so meaningless in this country. The public seems abysmally ill-informed, unprepared to protect themselves from what is increasingly an absolute certainty of collapse that will damage the country in enormous ways. If we were having this conversation in 1985 and I had said to you that the Soviet Union was going to disappear in 5 years, you'd have thought I probably wasn't very reliable. Well, I have to tell you, it's gone. It happens very fast these days. And there's nothing that says the same thing couldn't happen to us. It's just taken us another 15 years because we were always richer than the Russians. But we're getting into exactly the same kind of trap that they were in, and it very likely could bring us down. One of the most certain signs, however, is you would have thought if the American public knew anything, they'd know about habeas corpus, what might happen to you if you were simply locked in prison and there wasn't anything anybody could do about it. That just went out the window, and it's extremely serious alteration of our democracy.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles today, Dr. Chalmers Johnson.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Dr. Chalmers Johnson. He's an author and professor emeritus at the University of California, San Diego. He's the author of Blowback, The Cost and Consequences of American Empire, and The Sorrows of Empire, Militarism, Secrecy, and the End of the Republic. And he has a third book coming out, Nemesis, The Last Days of American Empire. And I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Rusty Wynn, the associate producer, Carol Kurth, the assistant producer, Jazz Shepard, the engineer. And I also make a special thanks to Alan Barker for engineering the Ambassador Peter Galbraith call from an interview we did from Amman, Jordan.